Let me tell you a few introductory things about Ford Motor Company and the general counsel's job at Ford Motor Company. I've been in the job almost 8 years. I had not worked in the company, or for that matter, I had not worked in a corporation other than some summer jobs and, you know, flipping burgers. I guess I was working for a corporation, but had not been in-house or in any other way since my law school graduation. So it was quite an immersion to me to show up at this Fortune 10 company as the chief legal officer without having had that experience or, frankly, knowing a lot about the company. I met exactly two people at Ford Motor Company before I started working there, one of whose name was Bill Ford. He had a sort of outsized role in selecting the general counsel. As you might imagine, his views carry a lot of weight. That's what happens when your name is on the building. You know, I kind of took a flyer on the job, because, and I think they took a flyer on me. We didn't really know each other very well, but it's been obviously quite an interesting ride given where the industry has been, where the economy has been, how our company has performed, and all the things that I've learned in that position. We have about 200 lawyers that work for me. They're all over the world, about 100 in the U.S. and about 100 scattered in other places around the world, Germany, China, Brazil, lots of other single lawyers in individual countries like Spain and Italy and the Philippines and Australia and lots of other places. Ford Motor Company, as you of course know, has been in business for 109 years and became global really early in its history. We celebrated our 100th anniversary of doing business in the UK a couple years ago. Next year we'll celebrate our 100th anniversary of doing business in Argentina. So Henry Ford had this vision to move around the world pretty early, and we continue to have a vibrant business in lots of other places in the world. Let me turn to the topic that I'd like to talk to you about today, and please be assured I'm going to reserve plenty of time for questions either about the topic or about anything else you want to ask about Ford or about my career or anything that's of interest to you at the end. You may have seen in the, I think there's been some publicity that it might have said Chipotle in large letters, and then, but the title of this little talk here is In-House Counsel in an Age of Regulatory and Litigation Excess. Now, I use the word excess is a bit more provocative than I perhaps intended, but I did want somebody to show up, so you're here, and I hope you find it interesting. But my point today is not really to make a value judgment about the quantity or, for that matter, the quality of litigation and regulation facing a Fortune 500 company in this country in 2012. There are, of course, plenty of value judgments to be made, and some of the information I will share with you could certainly provide the basis for a healthy debate about whether we've hit the right balance in terms of litigation or regulation, or whether we need some serious reform. But with respect to these issues today, I intend just to provide you with some information on the types of litigation and regulatory burdens faced by a company like Ford, and to use that information as the backdrop to offer some thoughts from the perspective of one general counsel about how you as law students should be thinking about and preparing to participate in the ever-changing role for in-house counsel that I perceive. It's my hope that these thoughts will be of interest to you on several levels. First, you may now think that you'll never be an in-house lawyer, but it is a perspective worth considering, even if you intend to be a law firm partner, a lawyer in a regulatory agency, a prosecutor, or a public interest lawyer. You certainly will have occasion to deal regularly with in-house counsel, particularly if you're in a law firm. You'll really want those people to be interacting with you because they'll be your clients and paying your rates. So I think it's important that you have an understanding of what the in-house world is like in this day and age. And second, for all of you, I hope that the perspectives will help you in your remaining time in law school to think about the profession more broadly and holistically than perhaps I did when I was a student or even a young attorney. It is, to me, a given that you will be technically proficient in the law, not just in legal rules, but in legal thought. But as I reflect on my time at the law school, that was the main focus for me. I had little understanding of or concerned with the broader skill set that would be necessary to truly succeed in the job that I have today. But technical proficiency and legal reasoning skills are simply what many in the business world refer to as hygiene factors, those whose presence is necessary but not sufficient to be an outstanding attorney. From that base, you should be giving careful thought and taking intentional action to develop the skills necessary to take that important but rather fundamental qualification to the next level so you can become trusted counselors in the fullest sense of the word. So to see the breadth of skills necessary for your careers, let me share with you some information about the legal environment in which in-house counsels, in-house lawyers at Ford and many other companies practice law. First, some thoughts about the litigation context. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, litigation in the U.S. costs companies over $250 billion a year, and the average Fortune 200 company spends over $100 million in litigation every year. I can assure you that at Ford, our costs are certainly consistent with that information, despite intense and successful efforts to manage costs. In many other professions and businesses, technology helps to reduce costs. In the legal profession, I'm afraid technology does not make litigation easier or cheaper for corporations. Quite the opposite, in fact, technology simply increases the frequency and volume of discovery demands and lessens judicial concern with what we perceive to be burden and abuse. A few years ago, at the dawn of the e-discovery era, which is relatively recent for those of you who don't know the history of it, we asked several judges sort of what their perspectives were on companies' compliance with e-discovery. And one of them told us that he believed that corporations should keep every version of every document ever written by every employee. Business cannot function, let alone succeed, under that kind of standard, and one can and should readily question the utility of operating on that basis. On average, U.S. litigation discovery requires corporations to produce over 1,000 pages for every page that is entered, that ever entered as an exhibit in a trial. We have routine litigation in which we can continually produce a set of hundreds of thousands of pages, and we look back and of the hundreds and thousands of pages that we've produced in certain types of litigation, fewer than several hundred have ever been introduced in a trial. So certainly preserving more documents does not necessarily lead to more just results for litigants. At Ford, at any given time, we have about 10,000 lawsuits pending in the U.S. These suits include product liability, consumer claims, asbestos, commercial and employment disputes, and intellectual property disputes. And by contrast, in Europe, where we have, as I said, a business that's been around for quite some time, and it's roughly on the order of magnitude about the size of our U.S. business, we have about 1,500 lawsuits compared to 10,000 here, with the majority of those being in Italy, France, and Germany. And those lawsuits are not just fewer in number, but they also involve much less financial risk to the company. The other factor about litigation is not just a question of numbers. It's also reflected, I think, in the tenor of some of the cases that a large company like Ford is required to defend. I'll give you a couple examples. Ford Motor Credit Company, which is our lending arm, is currently defending a lawsuit in California by two customers that defaulted on their car loans. After the vehicles were repossessed, they challenged the validity of a required post-repossession notice that told them how to get their vehicles back. This was a particular notice. California required that that notice be in 10-point font, and despite the word processing system's representation to the contrary on the form, the plaintiffs claimed that we used only 9.5-point font for a statement that was incidentally also boxed and bolded to draw their attention to it. They don't deny that the notice was clear, and nor do they claim that they didn't understand their options to recover the vehicle. But based on the claim that we violated a font size rule, they now seek certification of a class action to void all deficiency claims, return of amounts collected by Ford Credit pursuant to the clause at issue, and more than $1 million in punitive damages. And I'd like to tell you that case could be dismissed quickly. That is not the case. Of a similar tenor is a suit brought by a dealer who borrowed money from Ford to purchase his vehicle inventory and then defaulted on the repayment obligation. Taking the offensive, he sued Ford for lending him money, claiming we should have known that he couldn't pay. Simultaneously, he also claimed that we obstructed him from working his way out of debt because we refused to lend him more money. So in essence, we were being sued for lending him and for not lending him money in the same lawsuit. We also have hundreds of examples of frivolous product liability cases over the years, and obviously these cases take their toll, but what truly consumes resources are the cases that establish bad law. Let me give you one example. In a lawsuit in Florida, two intoxicated young men took a family member's car to go joyriding. After they crashed into a tree while speeding and unbelted, they sued Ford for their injuries. Although we won at trial, an appellate court reversed our victory on the ground that the trial court should not have admitted evidence of reckless driving, lack of seatbelt use, or intoxication. In its view, only the crashworthiness of the vehicle from the moment it hit the tree was relevant. No, the jury could hear nothing about what caused the accident. By our estimates, this ruling cost us $30 million a year in Florida. Fortunately, the decision was so offensive to reasonable people that the state legislature soon adopted a rule to override it, thanks to the work of some Ford attorneys in bringing this to their attention. Of course, it's not only litigation that increases the challenges facing in-house counsel. As you're well aware, we're in a period of increasing and expanding regulatory burdens. Government agencies have enacted more than 10,000 regulations per year for the past 10 years, and regulatory burdens are continually expanding. Certainly, this week's election results don't portend for any reduction in the regulatory burden facing companies doing business in this country. To take a major example, which you're all familiar with, the scope of regulation under the Dodd-Frank Act is sort of breathtaking. Enacted in July 2010 in the wake of a financial crisis, the Dodd-Frank Act requires nearly 400 rulemakings by numerous federal agencies, including the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the SEC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and the newly created Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. As of November 1st, about 100 of these rules have been finalized, about 150 are overdue, and another 150 have not even been proposed. Despite its genesis, Dodd-Frank goes well beyond addressing the issues that gave rise to the financial crisis. It includes many provisions that apply not just to financial services companies, but to all public companies doing business in the country. These include regulations related to such matters as executive compensation, shareholder rights, and whistleblowers. The cost of compliance, even for companies that had nothing to do with the financial crisis, are enormous. Perhaps the most extreme example of the far-reaching scope of Dodd-Frank is Section 1502, the conflict minerals provision. I don't know if you all have heard anything about the conflict minerals provision, so I'll give you a quick overview. This was enacted in an effort to reduce or eliminate the trade of certain metals in war-ravaged African countries where the use of forced labor is rampant, so a good purpose. In order to help serve that purpose, Dodd-Frank requires companies to disclose whether they use gold, tin, tungsten, or tantalum from the Congo or an adjoining African country in any of their products. To comply with this mandate, the SEC issued a rule requiring public companies to report whether their products contain these conflict minerals, and if so, to track the source and chain of custody of the minerals. They initially estimated that the rule would cost companies in the aggregate, $71 million annually, but in issuing the final rule, they revised that to $3 to $4 billion annually. Some third-party estimates put the cost to American businesses at as much as $16 billion. Let me give you an example of how this works, and you can see why it gets so costly. Take Ford as an example. We don't manufacture radios for our vehicles. What we do, and this is tell you how you go down the supply chain. We purchase radios from what we call Tier 1 suppliers and install them in the vehicles. The Tier 1 supplier purchases components such as LCD screens from what are called Tier 2 suppliers. They manufacture the screens with finished metals such as tin, solder for welding electrical connections, obtained from Tier 3 suppliers, who in turn obtain raw materials and metal ores from a variety of mines around the world. And what we're supposed to do is disclose in this filing with the SEC that we have a little piece of solder and that we know where it came from in a radio that we didn't build, that we bought from somebody that didn't build the component that contains the solder, that they bought from somebody who didn't mine it, et cetera, et cetera. So adapting to that regulation is going to be a significant challenge, and that's just one example. Another issue, and I think, frankly, something that has been probably the leading thing on the minds of in-house counsel for the past few years, is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. This is an anti-corruption law passed in 1977. It was enacted for the, again, a great purpose of making it unlawful for companies to make payments to foreign government officials to assist in or obtaining or retaining business, so prohibiting companies from bribing foreign officials. The amount of activity under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act has increased dramatically in the past 10 years. The investigations have gone from a couple a year to formal investigations now, about 20 cases per year. And this is not just a small matter for companies to determine what their employees are doing all around the world and to make sure that they're compliant. Ford has about 165,000 employees. That's direct employees, let alone suppliers, logistic people, dealers, and others who every day do things in the name of Ford Motor Company. I can tell you, my view, somewhere, somebody right now is doing something in the name of Ford Motor Company that they shouldn't be doing. I just can't tell you who it is or where they are or when I'm going to find out about it, if ever. The FCPA, however, and particularly in the current enforcement regime, requires you to have answers to those questions. And that the results, if you cross the line, can be somewhat staggering. There's no more cautionary tale than the case involving Siemens, which was not just some random person paying a bribe. It was, in fact, a decades-long bribery scheme by the company to retain a $1 billion contract to produce national ID cards for Argentinian citizens. But Siemens ended up paying $1.6 billion to resolve the charges. And they spent $1 billion to hire over 300 lawyers, which I guess maybe sounds good to all of you wondering what's next after law school. Today they have 600 full-time compliance personnel. Avon Products spent $280 million on internal investigations of possible FCPA violations for bribery in China. And Walmart has spent more than $51 million investigating bribery allegations in Mexico that surfaced after a big New York Times story. Whether any of these investigations has none of them has resulted in an investigation and a charge to date or a penalty, but of course the final chapters have yet to be written. So you can see there's ample reason to be concerned about the burdens on a modern corporation of litigation, regulation, and investigation. But you might also ask, so what? Are we to feel sorry for a company like Ford with more than $150 billion in revenues each year that it has to answer for its actions in court or comply with regulations or investigate allegations of wrongdoing? No, no sympathy is necessary. My point here is not to complain about FCPA investigations or about frivolous or even non-frivolous litigation or increasingly burdensome regulations. There is, of course, as I said, wide room for debate on each of these fronts and many others. The point is that they are the current reality faced by in-house counsel at public companies in the United States, and companies are requiring the in-house counsel be prepared to handle a full panoply of growing demands. This is a far cry, and you may not know the history of this, but this is a far cry from how in-house counsel were thought of in decades past. It used to be the case that in-house counsel was a nice place to go if you wanted, you know, you'd been a partner in Cravath for 20 years and you wanted to go and sort of have a quiet life and a quiet existence at at your client. In-house counsel was thought of a nice place to go out to pasture. Those days are gone. They really started changing not just because of the litigation and regulatory burdens, but also because some people took some different approaches to being in-house counsel and general counsel, starting about 20 years ago, maybe a little more than that. Ben Heineman at GE decided that he wanted to have, he was the general counsel at GE, he decided he wanted to have the best lawyers working for him in-house and directly, you know, answering to him rather than working through outside law firms. They didn't stop the use of outside law firms, but he built about a 1,000-person in-house legal department and started really changing the way that that lots of people thought about in-house counsel. Fast forward to the present in the kind of environment that I've just described to you, and you get the kind of thing that was described in a Wall Street Journal article just earlier this week concerning this shift and its effect on in-house lawyers. Under the heading, Lawyers' In-House Roles Grow with New Regulation, the article reported that companies facing mounting legal and regulatory risks increasingly rely on their own teams of lawyers as opposed to outside lawyers. General counsel, the article said, are taking on a more strategic role at some companies, working directly with chief executives on business goals, as well as legal issues and mapping out future risks. As new responsibilities are piled on in-house counsel, one prominent headhunter indicated that they need to bring a greater degree of judgment and agility to their tasks. The role, she said, is much more pivotal because of the complexity. In this legal atmosphere, the question for an aspiring in-house counsel, or one who wants to better understand the in-house environment, is how to be better prepared. What skills and experiences are important? As I said at the outset, it is a given that an in-house counsel must be skilled in the law. But what other skills does this mosaic of issues present to the modern in-house counsel, suggest would be necessary to succeed in the position? To focus on that issue, I want to share with you some thoughts on two ways that an in-house lawyer should conceptualize her role, in addition to thinking of herself as the person responsible for providing the correct legal answer. One of these concepts is very familiar, at least in terms of nomenclature, and the other is of more recent vintage. First, and no surprise to many of you, is the lawyer as counselor. By this, I do not mean simply what some lawyers have on their business cards, the old-fashioned counselor at law, which, by the way, is what the Virginia Board of Bar Examiners bestows on everybody who passes the bar, as I'm sure all of you will. Meaning someone who provides counsel on legal matters. Instead, when I talk about a counselor, I intend to describe something much broader. The best in-house lawyers not only provide the correct and best answer to legal questions, but also provide a strong voice on a whole range of non-legal issues to which they may be exposed in the course of their duties. Indeed, the roles of counsel and counseling are, I think, mutually reinforcing. It's a given that an in-house counsel must be in the room and have a seat at the table to offer legal advice when their clients are making a decision that has legal implications. That's basic. And if you're in-house and you're not at the table when that's happening, go look for another place to work. Once at the table, however, in today's in-house world, the lawyer is expected not only to offer the right legal answer, but is also supposed to be fully a member of the team and to offer judgments and opinions on a wider range of perspectives that must be considered. After the fact, regulators, plaintiffs' lawyers, and other audiences will not be content if you just say, I told them what the law was and I kept my mouth shut after that. This is not just a question of having an opportunity to offer policy judgments, ethical views, public affairs advice, or common sense. We are expected, as lawyers, to provide a wide spectrum of advice to our clients, so they are not criticized or embarrassed or otherwise harmed despite the legality of their actions. They may not always accept our views on this wider range of subjects, but we are derelict if we do not offer those views or not prepared to offer them, especially when we think something important is being overlooked. Time and again in my experience, both in-house and in Washington, I've observed places where lawyers were in the room when important decisions were being made, and they didn't offer basic ethical or other advice that would be expected. We must have the courage to do that. And indeed, I think in fulfilling this role as counselor, it's important, I would say necessary, for a lawyer in today's legal environment to consider a number of questions. And let me just share with you some of these that I would ask clients in certain situations. The proposed course of action is legally defensible, but is it ethical? Is it moral? Do you want to defend it? Or you'd be on solid legal ground to take the course of action you propose, but will it be misunderstood by the public or by the press? Or while the argument you want to make bolsters our legal position, is it possible that it's not necessary and might be misperceived? Do we want to make it anyway and risk criticism based on a misperception? Or finally, will regulators, shareholders, employees, or congressional committees think we're making a misguided decision despite its legal propriety? These considerations and many others come into play after giving our best legal judgment and ought to be a common part of the role of the lawyer to today's corporate clients. Indeed, the ABA model rules of professional conduct state, in rendering advice, a lawyer may refer not only to law, but to other considerations such as moral, economic, social, and political factors that may be relevant to the client's situation. In my judgment, the suggestion that a lawyer may refer to these factors is fine so far as it cabins the precise ethical duty of a lawyer. In the real world, however, consideration of these factors is close to imperative. And this, of course, is true not only for the in-house counsel, but also for the outside lawyer. But the point for the in-house counsel is they, since they live and breathe in the environment where these decisions are taking place, they're going to be in a position more often to ask those kinds of questions and to make those kinds of judgment. They're also much better known to the management of the company on a personal level than outside counsel would be. So in-house counsel has, a particular and special role when trying to ask the questions, that the kinds of questions that I suggest we have a burden and a duty and an obligation to ask as counselors to our clients. The second way for a lawyer to conceptualize the role of an in-house counsel in the environment I've described is as a legal risk manager. This is not, I would suggest, a description that many corporate counsel would have used to describe their role in decades past, but it's a very apt way to describe what we do in-house in 2012. Very rarely do the situations faced by the lawyers at Ford present black and white legal issues, nor do the trends I've described to you today lend themselves to all or nothing resolutions. Instead, we are constantly called on to make judgments about how to manage legal risk. It's partially based on knowing the right legal answer, but that is only the beginning of the task. In my role as general counsel at Ford, I am rarely called upon to say yay or nay on a legal issue. Instead, I am called on every day to decide how we should manage legal risk. That is the way I think our CEO and our board of directors would describe my duties. The legal risk we face occurs at various levels, and the in-house lawyer is required to manage, plan, and anticipate at each level. First, we face risk in individual matters. So risk could obviously arise in litigation matters, such as a $2 billion judgment against us in Ohio. It was entered against us last year in Ohio, and I was got a call on my cell phone from Bill Ford asking what happened. That was not a happy moment. We got it reversed. Or in a government investigation, a tax audit presents a lot of risk. Or the need to comply with the new regulations, such as the conflict minerals rules I described. Each of those individual situations can present risk that needs to be managed, and that's the most common way to think about managing legal risk. But the risk we face also arises through the accumulation of like matters that must be managed holistically and strategically. For example, included on our litigation docket are thousands of asbestos-related matters. And as a company that mass-produces products, we face pattern litigation, repeat plaintiffs' lawyers, and potential class actions all the time. Similarly, regulation of dealers or insurance matters often takes place in similar ways across many jurisdictions. At this level, the in-house lawyer must not simply treat each matter as a one-off, but instead must devise a strategy that has a consistent long-term view toward managing and reducing the risks. and the systemic effect of these risks. At Ford, taking the long-term view as managers of legal risks has led us to decisions that in a specific instance might not appear to make a lot of sense. We will, for example, appeal a case of limited financial importance because we believe that it can be used to develop the law in our favor, or is a good vehicle to have a law that's against us reversed. We routinely turn down offers to settle matters that would resolve them for less than our litigation expenses because we think strategically about how to manage our overall litigation docket. And the plaintiff's lawyers who try to make their living out of suing Ford are repeat players. We can't think about them in individual cases. We need to think about a strategy for managing them across many matters. Understanding that you are managing overall systemic legal risk to the company compels the in-house lawyer to think more strategically and to take a long-term view of overall risks. Third, at the highest level, we think of the risk presented by the overall legal and regulatory system. We pursue civil justice reform and legal reform that we believe is in the interest of the company. We work with others to seek legislative change and to influence public opinion in the face of out-of-control litigation or unduly burdensome regulations. And we work closely with our colleagues in government affairs and public affairs to shape the perception of the company on legal and regulatory matters in a way that benefits our company. So what then is the role of in-house counsel in an age of litigation and regulatory excess? Counsel should think of themselves as a lawyer, counselor, and legal risk manager. Performing these tasks is certainly demanding. It requires foresight, judgment, political skill, and wisdom. As law students, you should be anticipating not just the need to provide legal advice, but the panoply of skills necessary to serve the broader functions I've described. Let me just give you and tick off a couple of areas that I think are worth thinking about. Constantly sharpening and refining your ethical antenna. You need to develop a moral compass that tells you what's right and what's wrong in any particular situation, and resolve to yourself never to set aside your moral and ethical compass when you're giving legal advice to a client. You should be a student of the press and of public perception. Both the press and the public are notoriously fickle and hard to predict. To truly serve our clients, we have to have a strong sense of how things will be judged in the event they are made public. Third, you should think a lot about politics and politicians. When issues touch on public policy, be aware of the views held by influential political players. Who are they? What do they think? Because if they don't like what you did, you're going to be called before a hearing in Congress and have to answer for it anyway. Take the long view. Learn to think strategically. Learn how to analyze financial issues. Know your business and your client's business inside and out. In order to have credibility with senior leadership, you need to earn a seat at the table. You must be interested and educated, not just in the legal matters that come across your desk, but in the business itself. So those are some of the things that I think you should think about in this new world for the in-house counsel. Obviously, it's a broad interdisciplinary approach. But perhaps more than anything, I would say in closing, the in-house counsel must be a great teammate and a colleague. Never afraid to address important issues, legal or otherwise, but respecting and deferring to the expertise of others as well. This will help you develop strong, long-term relationships, which are not only imperative to success, but will give your company clients a reason to give you a seat at the table and invite you back again and again. Right now, despite the highly uncertain times we're in, Ford is enjoying its 13th straight quarter of profitability after coming through the financial crisis. That is a very satisfying thing for somebody in-house in my position. And our legal team is very proud of the company and all that we've been through and the ways in which we contributed. We are invested in the company's long-term viability. We recognize the challenges of regulation, the dangers of litigation, the gravity of government investigations, which are all on the rise. However, we also love the opportunity to think strategically about the law, to counsel broadly on legal and extra-legal matters, and to work cooperatively with our company clients. Being an in-house counsel has changed a lot, but it has never been more challenging or intellectually rewarding. And with that, I will stop and ask for your questions.